Hi, you're listening to Secrets for an Inspirational Life with me, your host, Mimi Novick. I'm so happy and thrilled to have you here with me. I have created this series for all of us so we can change our world together and live a more holistic and balanced life. Together, we will share lots of inspiring stories from all walks of life, speak with leading experts, enjoy healthy living ideas, explore music and subjects that inspire each other to always have hope. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate all of you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Secrets for an Inspirational Life. How are you all today? I hope that there's a little magic and a little beauty surrounding you. And I hope that there are new chances on the horizon. I'm often wondering when new chances arrive, do we always realize that they are something that can change our lives? Sometimes we are afraid, like all of us, and we wonder what it is actually that can develop from meeting new people, from taking the risk and having the courage to change our lives. But we must embrace these changes because this is the law of life. Nothing stays the same. So with that in mind, I am absolutely delighted and very excited, as you all know, I get very excited about my guests, to welcome my special guest today, who is the very interesting and rather lovely Ricky Baker. Ricky is an entrepreneur specializing in Asian action cinema. Ricky was instrumental in bringing martial art movies and Hong Kong cinema to the masses through his UK-based Eastern Heroes company, which is a well-known brand around the globe. Along with Kung Fu movie expert Toby Russell, Ricky introduced the genre to a new global audience. He provided many of Hong Kong's leading lights with their first appearances outside of Asia, hosting events with the likes of Donnie Yen, Jet Li, Chow Yun-fat, Gordon Liu, and John Woo. Ricky has produced documentaries and published well over 70 books and magazines. He presented the TV show with Jonathan Ross for the BBC called Stop Kung Fu, a 6-part series featuring many star guests. Currently, he is writing a new book with Ken Miller and Hollywood movie director Brett Ratner. Today, he shares his story. Welcome, dear Ricky.
Well, thank you, Mimi. And listening to that introduction, I feel that it makes me sound great.
great, Ricky.
I'm going to take this and play it to all the family members who think I didn't amount to much.
But you are great. You're a superstar in your own right.
It's a very niche, I'm right. But it all said and done, it's at least you feel you've had a purpose in life, even if you're talking to a small group of people. You know, it's more, yes. I tend to find it looks more of a cult than when you meet the people out there. But no, it's great. And it's been, there's nothing more rewarding, I think, if you can do something that is something you have passion for, because when you have passion, you put a lot more in, you'll work a lot more hours, you'll go the extra 9 yards. So if you're doing something just to pay the bills, it's much more difficult. So I'm even if you're not making a lot of money, you do feel rather gifted, and you have to take gratitude that you're doing something for the book of the week, which is what work is. You're doing something that you enjoy rather than just a labor of, you know, something you've got no passion for.
Yes, absolutely. And you have done so many things, though, from, you know, working in holiday camps to being on the TV to being a croupier There's so many things that you have done prior to setting up this company of yours that's worldwide. So let's start somewhere, because I want to introduce you to the audience a little bit more about where it all started from. Tell us a little bit about where this fascinating life of yours began.
Okay, well, I come from a small town called Hinckley in the Midlands. And back in the day, there wasn't much adventure there. My sister had got married to a guy in the RAF, and so she was going into married life quite young. They're still together 52 years later. And my brother left. He took the opportunity in 1974 to emigrate to New Zealand with a pen friend of my sister's. So he'd gone to New Zealand and he'd escaped, because all on offer for somebody like myself at the time was very menial jobs. You could either, Leicester has a very big, at the time had a very big boot and shoe and a manufacturing base, or mining. And a lot of my family were miners. So at school, even though at the beginning I looked like a high achiever, I wanted to be a doctor, by the time I was 11 or 12, I'd sort of fell away from that, maybe hanging around with the wrong people. But unfortunately, I had a very bad home life. I had a very violent home life. And my father was very violent towards my mum and me. And I think that affected me deeply at school, you know, because you become almost terrified. You know, he was like Jekyll and Hyde. He could be lovely and then he could be a demon. And I think the tragic turning point for me was I was 14 and I'd been a Bruce Lee fan since hearing of his death in 73, only through articles, only through clips that they were showing on TV about this new superstar from Hong Kong. And so I tried to get in to see Enter the Dragon, and I got turned away because I was only 14. And I didn't look, I was so baby-faced. So they sent me away, and I thought, I'm not going to give up. And I remember listening to the film through the back doors. And my friend, who was a year older than me, looked older. He managed to get in quite easily. But for me, I couldn't get in. I went home. I put some platform shoes on. I cut my hair. I made a mustache out of my hair. And it looked pathetic. But I gave it every go I could. And so the frustration of going to that cinema every night and just looking at the posters and that, and I so badly wanted to see it. We moved forward a few months when the movie came back around again, and my mum said to me, would you like to go to the pictures? And she gave me and my friend Gary at the time a pound and said, you know, go to the pictures. As it happens, Enter the Dragon was planned that week. And so I said, well, nothing ventured, nothing gained. Let's go and see Enter the Dragon. And I stood milling around in the foyer with my back to them while he, who was older than me by about 2 years, 16, managed to get the tickets. And then we sort of shuffled in with our head down. And I got in. And I had to sit through the first film, which wasn't so great because in those days it was a double bill. And we sat watching and the Enter the Dragon came on. And it was absolutely like a divine intervention. You see something that you become transfixed with. And like all young people at the time, when leaving the cinema, you was doing all these kung fu moves. You thought you could take on a gang of 10 guys if they attacked you. And so I bounced and skipped all the way home. And it wasn't until I got to the house and I saw the door was slightly ajar. And that's strange. So I pushed it open and anybody in? And gone in, and the house looked empty, but there was a note on the table, and it was from my mum saying that she couldn't take the violence anymore and that she'd left. She was sorry that she couldn't take me with her. But my school was close, and she thought my dad would be a lot more less troublesome if it was just me and him. And she wouldn't give me the address in case my dad forced it out of him. So she's left. My dad's come home and he looks quite shocked. And for that moment in time, he said, oh, dear, what are we going to do now, son? He did love my mum. He really did. But he couldn't contain his jealousy. My mum was quite a fun-loving woman and quite flirtatious. And I don't think it suited him. So we started to get okay. Eventually, I found where my mum was, and she'd moved in. She now had a caravan. She'd met a lorry driver who was completely different to my dad. He was completely opposite. He was a driver for Birdseye. And he was a soft and gentle man, and it couldn't be no different. Although I always felt my mum held a torch for my dad because she would sometimes say good things about him. But life at home became quite unbearable with me and my dad. And I think I clung on to the Bruce Lee, and you have to have a hobby. You need something to throw yourself into. And so that was what I was doing. And it wasn't until I was sort of 19, I'd left school at 15, because in those days you took your exam at your GCSEs in the summer, and then the school broke up, and my birthday was in the August, so I was always one of those late people. I was always at the end, but I still qualified to be in that year, so I did the exams, left school, and ended up doing sort of menial jobs, carpet fitter. Work in an electronics factory. In those days, you could just go from job to job. You just went on the labour exchange and you could get a card. And I realised that, and then I got a job at the co-op and I did curries as well as a salesman, and I realised I was quite good at selling. And I met my first girlfriend, a proper girlfriend, who was a waitress in the club. And cut a long story short, after a few weeks, months, I moved in with her. She had this house. I didn't realise for a while she lived on her own, but her mum and dad lived in Saudi. And we had a fantastic year. We never fell out. It was like the real thing. Unfortunately, her mother came home, and we felt that she'd be good knowing I lived there. We really thought that. And she seemed lovely and she seemed okay. But her father was very possessive and wanted to make sure that her daughter married somebody of substance, which sadly I wasn't. I was just a bit of a Jack the Lad. So so she's gone back, and I remember it clearly that we was asleep in bed, and suddenly I felt a hand come over my mouth. And I opened my eyes and I saw two guys in military. And one had his hand over her mouth and my mouth. And of course, instantly you think the worst. You can't help it. But within moments, they were saying, don't worry, we're not here to hurt you. And one of them turned to Sally and said, Sally, get dressed and go downstairs. That guy left, and the other guy said, put some clothes on. We're not going to hurt you. Come downstairs. We need to talk to you. And so we sat down there, and I was sort of trembling a bit. And they said that, because her father was in the military, and he'd sent a couple of what I can only describe mercenaries to come and escort me out the house. And so we were just sort of looking at each other, and I thought, don't worry, you know what I mean? I thought they were just going to take her somewhere for a few days and she'd come back and I'd join her. But I got a few things. I didn't have that much stuff there. We got a few things together. They walked out, they got in the car, and I overheard them saying they'll take her to the station. And I knew where she was going. She was going to go up, because I'd stayed there during our time together when she had to go back to Saudi with her auntie in the Lake District. So I managed to run to the main road, flag a cab down and race to the station. And I got there, and I couldn't see anything. And I got there, and I saw a train on the other side. So I had to run over the platform. And when I got to the other side, the train was taking off. And as that was taking off, she looked out the window. And I'm chasing. It's like one of these romantic disaster comedies. And I can't catch up with her. And she's waving. I'm saying, call me. Write to me. I never heard from her again. And so I think at that stage, losing my mum, disappeared and the first love of your life, it set me up for sort of a a difficult few years.
Wow. Oh my goodness. I was there in those moments with you as you were telling the story, Ricky, and what a traumatic time.
It is, because it does affect you with your relationships. I think I went out and I didn't really want to get close to anybody ever again, because I thought as I got close to somebody, you would be telling yourself mentally, you know, and a lot of girls like me. I was quite a good looking guy in my day. And so it wasn't hard to get the girls, but you would almost end it the moment they asked you out. You thought, well, I'm not going to get hurt again. And it's just a natural thing. And I think it was at that stage, I realized that I wanted to get out of that town. It had too many bad memories. And, you know, sometimes out of bad things come good things. If you can turn a negative into a positive, which I wasn't really necessarily thinking that way at the time, but if you can turn a negative into a positive, then, you know, you can do something. And an opportunity arose. And my mum had got some money from my dad's divorce. And she said to me, would you like to go and see your brother in New Zealand for 6 months? It wasn't easy, because back in those days to go to New Zealand, you had to prove you could have enough money in the bank to support yourself. You couldn't work and you had to have a residence. So my mum gave me sufficient money to have about 200 New Zealand dollars for 6 months. So she put $1,200 and she got me a plane ticket. It was my first time ever traveling. And I went to my brother, and that completely changed my way of life by traveling to there, seeing my brother with his happy wife, with his own business, with this beautiful house and good friends. It was a complete change. And I think that acted like a therapy for me, because I think if I'd have stayed where I was, the future didn't look that good for me. You know, it was either going to be, terrible to say, criminal or just, you know, doing a dead-end job. I'm not degrading dead-end jobs, but sometimes you feel you can do better. And so that opportunity of going to New Zealand and spending 6 months with my brother and going out into the bush with him and going out with work, and I got to know the guys around him. I come a part of the fire brigade, because out there you have to man your own fire station, because he lived in the bush. His house was sort of like was on stilts. And so if they ever caught fire, that fire engine wouldn't be able to make it in time. It got bad, so you had to have your own one. So I become a part of that. I helped become a builder. And then I met this fantastic guy in the shopping mall called Charlie Brown. He was an East End orphan. And he was selling, it was the new craze, was these Yamaha organs. And they were called one key players. So you could hit a button and music would start. And, dum, 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 dum. And then you'd play one key and you could almost create like you had a band with you. And I said, that's fantastic. He says, Rick, I've got a great idea. Why don't me and you go door to door selling these of an evening? I said, Rick, wow. And he said, I think you're a good salesman. What we'll do is we'll create a brochure. When you're in New Zealand going down the drives, their letterboxes aren't on the street. They've got like a letterbox at the very end of maybe a 50-foot drive. And we should do that, because in New Zealand, you have to make an appointment. You can't just knock on a door, and you must do all your calls before 9 o'clock. So I said, I'm game. And so he created this. He said, Ricky, you're going to be the stooge. You don't play. He said, but I'm going to teach you to play Green Sleeves and When the Saints Come Marching In. And here's the real selling point. Once we've done this and we've gone in there, but we've shown them, we've given them like a demonstration, then we'll get the kids, then we'll get the people all to try to teach them to play. And then we'll say to them, look, it's very late at night. We're going to leave this overnight and we'll come back tomorrow. Knowing full well, hopefully, that by the time that we went back the next day, they loved it so much that they wanted to buy it. And it worked. And it worked. We become these like grifters, going door to door. I've never played, it was the truth. And I said, but watch me with my one finger and this. And especially the Maoris, they loved it. You know what I mean? He would come on and do something a little bit more dancified, and they would dance. And the catch was leaving in the house for the month. And so I started to learn these tricks of the trade. And that happened for a while. And then he fell a bit ill, so we had to stop. So I thought, well, I quite enjoyed what I'm doing. And I saw an advert for an encyclopedia salesman. And I thought, well, I've got the skills now. I'm really, you know, I look the part, I can go. So I went down for this meeting, this group of people. And the company was Collier's Encyclopedias. And the idea is they drop you off, you knock on doors, you make an appointment, then you go back to the appointment. And so because I was very mouthy, very cocky, and, you know, very like Jack the Lad, they'd sort of planned to send me into a place called Frostbite Place. And Frostbite Place, which I didn't know, only 2 weeks before had been inundated with Grolier. There's a company called Collier, and then there's Grolier, very similar. And they decided that they did this like in the mall, win a free home thing. And what I realized, there's always knocking on the doors. And sometimes I got chased away. One guy chased me with a pitchfork. Once you get these, they're knocking on the door, I'm so sorry. You know, we've already got a set. Look, and they opened the door and they said, how come everybody? They said, oh, you don't know. There's a big event a couple of weeks ago and people had the chance to have a free home, you know, demonstrator of encyclopedias. And I thought, I've been stitched up. And I was just giving up. And I went to this house and this lady opened the door, said, hi, I know you've got a set of encyclopedias. Could I just practice on you? And she said, actually, we don't. We weren't here when they did that. We was away at my mother's. And we would like to have a set. I said, you know, I said, well, I'd love to do a presentation for you. She says, well, my husband's not back just yet. He's a long distance larger, back in about half an hour. Would you like to come in and have a cup of, you know, drink, coffee or something? I said, sure. And we went in and we sat down and I said, I'm so grateful because I haven't had a customer yet. And I said, you know, I know I'm going to go back and they're just going to laugh their head up so they play with this. Anyway, a husband rings up, said, I'm running a bit late. She tells me, he says, fantastic. I'll look forward to seeing it. Do you know what? I sat with that woman till 12:30 at night. And I thought, her husband's not going to think great of this. And then suddenly he comes to the door apologizing, saying, I'm so sorry, the traffic. And I said, he said, it's 12:30. He said, you're still here? I said, well, I just need to do a demonstration. What's your name? I said, Rick. He said, Rick, let me just get a coffee and do it. And I get this presentation. And at 2:45 in the morning, I signed them up. I was so ecstatic. But by the time I left and went out, the car that's supposed to wait for you no matter what had gone. And I had to walk 7.5 miles through the bush, these darkened lanes with these noises that sounded like I was in Jurassic Park, back to my brother's. But I was so happy. I tried thumbing a lift, but they must have thought I was some sort of hitchhiker killer. And I got to and I went back down the next day and they couldn't believe that I had sold $1,100 worth of books and signed it at sort of 2:45 in the morning. But I hated them for doing it, so I just left. And by that stage, my 6 months was coming up. So it was back to England I went.
Oh, my goodness. It's remarkable, really, where a twist in fate, as they say, takes you on a completely different path and, in effect, sometimes can save your life. Inadvertently, you don't even realize that. I'm a great believer, Ricky, in, you know, things happen for a reason. And this moment in your life of going to New Zealand was transformational. But then what happened when you came back to England?
You know, I'd seen a new life. I took my car test out there because at 15 you can drive. Living, seeing everybody out there working for themselves. And then going back to, I guess it's a bit like you go to a 5-star hotel for a week and then you come back home to your home and think, well, this is terrible. You know, I'm so lovely where I was before. So you start to, at that age, think, you know, I'd seen a whole new world. And I realized that for sure now that staying in Hinckley wasn't for me. But I wasn't sure how to get out because I had no skills. The only skill I had was my mouth. And that back in those days, you know, it's not like today. There isn't telemarketing. You know, you really faced a bleak future unless you had some good qualifications or you went to tech or university. And it came up, just again, these things happen almost like, whether I was being very clever and I was talking to the universe and willingly manifesting these things to come, I don't know. But I was desperately looking, and I was still, but I used to practice some magic, and I was thought about going to join the magic circle. And I become quite dexterous and good at it. And then in the paper, they were looking for people to work at Butlins. And it didn't feel right in the caravan with my mum. I had such a small room, and you know, you couldn't really bring a girl back or anything. And you're that age where you wish you could. And so there was an advert in the Hinckley Times saying Butlins workers wanted. So I rang up, and there was many areas, and I wanted to work on the Dodgems in the fairground, like David Essex. You know, I said, I'm going to go and work on that. That's where all the girls will be, and I'll be good at that. You know what I mean? And so, you know, and they said to me, okay, well, I applied. And in those days, what you got was you got your room and board and food and quite a nominal amount of money. I think it's about 12 quid a week. And I got the bus and I went there and I turned up, and they said, I'm sorry, you know, that there is no work on the Dodgems, or on the fair. And I was really upset. And I said, what can I do? And they said, we think you'd be good in the Viennese ballroom with the other people doing boring dancing. You know, they'll like you. You've got a nice personality. You can talk to the old ladies in there. They'll love you. And that's where I ended up. I ended up with another older woman. And I worked that bar for the whole season. Now, the twist of fate in this story is that as it was coming towards the end of the season, people did get sacked, and people did get wrong for getting drunk or stealing something. And I sort of survived it. And believe it or not, on the row I was staying, I actually moved to another row where it's more the high-end people. I remember I was next to Paul Daniels' son and Charlie Drake's son. I'm sure if they're of a certain age, know Charlie Drake and Paul Daniels' son. And so it was like a stepping stone for people who had entertainment and artistic abilities. So I was down there, and the guy I was sharing the room with, the guy called Mark Piggins, said to me, oh, Rick, there's a job going. He said, you want to go to London? They're looking for croupiers. He said, I've seen you with the magic and your coins. You're probably just ideal for it. Actually, not really, because you could be cheating. But at the time, he said, you should go. And I said, I haven't got any money. I haven't got money for the fare from Clacton to London. I don't have a suit. I said, I'd love to go. And so I went to see, I knew one of the old security guards, and I said to him, I've got to try and get to this event. It's on Friday. Unfortunately, it's Friday. The Butlins is closing down the next day. And so a lot of people sort of abscond before that happens, you know. So they usually hold the money back till they've finished that week. And he said to me, oh, okay, Rick. I said, no, I really need to go. I said, I need a suit and I need 20 quid until I get paid. And he said, I'll have a word. And he went and spoke to Billy Butlin, well, one of the Butlins. I told him my story, and he actually lent me 20 quid in advance, and the guy, I can't remember his name, so sadly, lent me one of his suits. It was a little bit big, but I got on that train and turned up, and there was over 1,200 people interviewing for 7 days. And in those days, to be a croupier, you had to be trained for 6 weeks to work in the Ritz. I mean, you had to be good. You had to look the part. You had to look good in a suit. And you had to be able to be very, very good at maths. Luckily, I'm very good at mathematics in terms of your basic, like, multiplication, because I'd worked in bars. And so I went for this interview, and I got down to the 120. And they said, you know, you need to come back to do a two-week induction course. And if you pass that, then, you know, you'll be taking out the 70 people we're looking for, because they had six clubs. I got through that, and I ended up going home, and I begged my mum to sub me for a. My mum wasn't rich. That was the terrible thing about it. You know, she hadn't really got much money. And I asked her if I could go, and I needed to go for this 2 weeks. And could she sub me for this YMCA hotel for a couple of weeks? And so I could attend because the classes are over the road. And she did, God bless her, she did. How she did it, I don't know. And I went down. And you know something? It was like Johnny Go Home. I was so naive of London. I mean, there's some really funny stories. I don't know if I'll tell them here, you know. You know, there is, I will interpret on one. I'm there and I've gone for the first day and I've gone over in the YMCA, which is a hotel as well as a YMCA. Because I'd actually stayed there for a while before when I was living in London. I had a room there. We managed to get it. They used to have to let so many rooms out to people. So anyway, I've gone over to the it was afterwards. So I've gone over there and I'm in the bar and I said, there's hairdressers. Anyway, I said, at the lunchtime. So I said, my haircut. And he said, oh, well, he said, I'm quite pleased. He said, what's it for? So I'm in the croupier course. I said, oh, I've got a friend who's a croupier. Come tonight, I'll cut your hair. I'll give you the last appointment. And if you want, I'll bring my friend along and he'll give you some advice. I said, that's fantastic. So I went back and at 5:30 when I left over, I walked over there, went and had my hair cut. And then he said to me, he closed the shop, said, we're going to meet my friend at my flat. I live on Charing Cross Road. Let's go down there. And then we're going to have a drink. And I said, okay, naively. And I was a pretty boy. So, you know, it was easy. So I went down there, up to his thing, and I'm sitting in his lounge. And there's this fantastic poster of this woman with like a veil, like a Turkish woman with the headdress on, with the diamonds, and these stunning eyes. And he said, what do you think of the poster? I said, gosh, I said, those eyes are mesmerizing, stunning. And he smiled. He left the room. He left the room. And 20 minutes, I come in. And he had no top on, but these tassels on his nipples. And he had that mask on. And he goes, that is me in the poster. And was dancing, belly dancing in front of me. And said, look, it's me. And he said, look, he pulled the scarf down because he had a beard. And pulled it up and said, look at the eyes. It's me. And I said, wow. Really? He said, you thought the eyes were stunning? It's me. Did that post on me, a few years ago, but I still have the eyes. And he said to me, we're going to have so much fun tonight. And I said, oh, God, I'm in trouble here. I could hit this guy. I know I could do that, but was that the right thing? And I thought, his friends are coming. I'm just going to be molested.
Oh, God.
I made some excuse. Listen, let me just go back. I have to go and sign the form. Because the form said, yeah, I have to go back at the 7 to sign. I said, so I'll do that and I'll run back down here. And he goes, okay, well, then be quick. And I got out there and I ran. And I wanted to go home. I thought, this is just terrible. I ran back into the YMCA and sitting at the bar, and this guy said to me, you okay? I said, oh, God. I said, no, not really. And he said, oh, and he had a Vickers collar on. And he said, oh, I said, okay. He said, what's that? I said, oh, I said, I think I'm going to go back home. I said, I've got a room here for about a week. I said, but I've just, you know, I'm training to be a croupier. Splendid, he said. And I said to him, you know, but I just don't know if I can make it. He said to me, Mr. Silly, he said, I only stay here once a week. He said, I have a permanent room here. He said, if it helped you out, you could stay there. And as he said that, he put his hand on my leg. And said, you don't have to pay anything. Just be friendly with me when I stay here. And I just jumped off my seat and thought, I'm just going to be forever haunted by men wanting me.
Oh, God.
Anyway, I passed the course and ended up working. I started at the Golden Nugget and Sportsman and ended up to the Palm Beach and the Ritz. I did it for 6 years and it was a really good experience because London nightlife was seen differently because we worked shifts and went out at night time late, but it was all building up, you know, it was all a complete change of life to me. It's not something I never planned to do, and now I'm in London, but I'm getting itchy feet, and I go back home. I go and live in Greece for 6 months. Well, it's meant to be going around the world, but I think as far as Crete, with a friend of mine, and I ended up going back home. So I've had these real sort of, by the age of sort of 25, 26, I've had a real sort of different life. I've been living in Greece, I've lived in London, I've done this, I've done that. And it was making me never feel like I could settle down or become stable. I seemed like I needed excitement constantly. And so.
Why do you think that is, Ricky? What do you think was the reason for that? Of yearning excitement?
I like excitement. And it's, I think I like the unknown. And I didn't really know that. It's only because you go through several things you do. I mean, all my friends were now married. They were settled down. They were working normal jobs. I'd go back home. And, you know, I'm not being funny. At the age of 25, but they had a school reunion, like a 10-year school reunion. And the teachers had said to me, was it 25 or 30? Yeah, it'd be 19. No, I left school in 1976. So in 1987, when I left the casino, there was a school reunion, which I found about. And at the time, I had managed to buy a white XJS, like a, you know, like the Temple, the James Bond car.
The Jag, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I could barely afford it. And I remember them saying, a girl that I used to go out with, we went to school together since we was five, said, this is, are you going to come up? And I said, well, she said, oh. I said, they always said I'll never amount to much. You know, they'll give me bad reports. She said, oh, I said, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to come up in my white jacket. I'm going to get a fur coat and hat and tell them I'm a pimp in London and see what the teachers say. Did you were right. I've got 9 girls working for me. And you know something? The guys loved it. The women came up and said, what's it like? You're a pimp. I said, yeah. And I said, you know, they called me Tricky Rich. And I said, you know, I said, handled 9 girls. I said, but I look after them. And they all fed into it. And the teachers, they believed it, hook, line, and sinker. They said, we knew you'd do something like that. We knew. I said, yeah. I said, I just sort of fell into it. And I just lied the whole night and had some the most fun because every one of them thought out of everybody in the school, in that thing, I was the most fascinating person. They looked at the jag and the coat. I looked the part. I looked like a pimp. And I tell you something, I had girls that at the school at the time used it with nice, they'd come to me saying, I'd love to come to London because I don't know if I'd want to work for you, but you know, and I said, really? And it was bizarre. And so so that was me sort of, I felt really good that I never told them any different. I left, leaving and think that I was an East End pimp. With 9 women working for me, I managed to tell the story so convincingly, you know, and they all bought it hook, line, and sinker. And now anybody else, they might not have believed it, but me, they agreed that that was probably one of the only ways I was going to make money, is to become a pimp. So it was interesting, you know, and that was an interesting time, you know, but. But with the casino going, I've been abroad, I really needed something else. And I wanted to go back to London. And it was at this time, because I'd stay in the YMCA, I went to stay with a friend of mine, Lloyd, who I'd been abroad with for 6 months. And he said to me, let's get a flat. I said, I've got no money. And he said, well, the YMCA, they let a dozen rooms out a year. They have to for the council. And he said, you can sign on. And we can get in there. So we queued. We got there early. We queued for like 24 hours in the foyer. And we were one of the first ones at the door. And we got the room. And so I was now living in the YMCA, the place that I hated. when I was back in London, the room was being paid for, and I needed to come up with a new idea. And by now, I'd become very much sort of a hustly. I was a nice guy, but I just hated the thought of having to do a normal job or working normal. And I hadn't got the qualifications. I was an academic. My grades were terrible. So on paper, you wouldn't hire me. So I went into Chinatown and the first couple of weeks there, they used to do the late night kung fu movies at the Empire Leicester Square. And because I lived so close to it, I didn't have to worry about getting up. I would go to the midnight movies, and I saw this film called Eastern Condors. Nobody probably listening to this will understand that film, but it was a fantastic sort of like Dirty Dozen martial art action film with a guy called Sammo Hung. And it re-sparked everything I loved about Asian cinema. And so I went back then. I thought, I want to get back into Hong Kong cinema. This is it. I knew a guy called, I can't remember his name, another guy that was living in the YMCA, and he wanted to set up a little store like they did in Carnaby Street, selling handcuffs and leather gloves. And at the time we were doing this, the two big things that were selling on the market stores was ASEED badges, those yellow badges with a smiley face on, mm-hmm. and Bross was huge at this moment. So there's a guy I used to talk to in Chinatown. He was at a TV and repair shop, and I suggested to him, could we put a stall, like a railing outside your thing, and we're going to sell belts, handcuffs, Bross, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, then we'll give you a share of it. We'll go and buy the stuff. You know, we'll try and do it. And Keith, his name was Keith, had some money, about 150 quid. So we went, and he goes, okay. And so he allowed us to go there and set up this stall in Chinatown. And we noticed a lot of people, you know, would come by. We were doing okay. We weren't killing it. But, you know, but at the time, Bross badges, Bross scarves, ASEED badges, handcuffs did very well for some reason. And then people would come up to me and say, where can we buy kung fu films from? And I'd say, Chinatown's the shops around on the main Shaftesbury Avenue. And so we've been in, they don't sell us. They're saying, oh, they're Chinese, they're not subtitled. And I said, well, I said, you know, and John Fung, who owned the shop, his uncle was one of the owners of the shop. And he did all he brought the films into the community, the TV series and 35 mil prints. And so he said, well, I can get some of these films for you. I'll get them and we'll run them and we'll split the profit. And so we got three or four films and we ran them in plastic bags. And then people kind of said, well, I've got some films actually. If you want to buy, I said, I can get them. I will sell them to you. And we got well known for doing pirate tapes in this section. And they used to be 25 quid each. So you can imagine it was reasonable money. And people would come down and they'd start to know who I was, you know. And they, you know, we and then I partnered with a guy who would access the films as well, a guy called Chris. And he said, what we should do is we should do a film show. There's no more late night, but we should look at doing one. There was a cinema in the King's Cross that did alternative movies every day. And so I asked John if we could rent three of the best martial art films and we would do a screening in London and just see how it went. And I caught up this guy in combat and he took the call because my name's Rick Baker. Now, Rick Baker, there's a famous Rick Baker who does a lot of effects like Werewolf in London. He did the Thriller video with Michael Jackson. His name's Rick Baker too. So stupidly thought it was him. And he let me, I said, I want to put an advert in. And he said, what we're going to do, that's a great idea. He loved the movies too. It was coming up big, you know, Kung Fu was still quite underground, but the movies, but there wasn't enough in the video shops. So we put the three films on and I had this poster going around, you know, saying triple bill. And then, as fate would have it, as it always does with me, a guy walked past and said, "I'm Mike Gaby." He said, "I'm a producer." There's a guy who's got a TV show and he's thinking of doing something new. And he would like to pick your brains. And I said, "Wow." He said, his office is in Greek Street, I think, or Wardour Street. So his name's Jonathan. So we had this meeting, and it was Jonathan Ross. And at the time, Jonathan was doing The Last Resort. And this is in 1989. And he says to me, "I want to do something with Bruce Lee." I said, "No, you want to do Jackie? Let me help you." You know, he goes, "He's the up-and-coming guy. He's like comedy kung fu." But Jonathan got behind it, and we did this. We did this episode called Incredibly Strange Picture Show. He did 6 episodes, and I worked on 2 of them. And at the same time, Channel 4 took his suggestion that they should do like a Friday night kung fu sort of horror movie. And it was that moment through Jonathan and Channel 4 mainstreaming some of these sort of underground movies that it suddenly lit up. And we had started doing the Jackie Chan fan club. We had about 1,000 members. We were making good money. We was doing bootleg tapes through mail order at an office. Excuse me, my throat's a bit gone. And this sort of took me into another world, knowing Jonathan Ross, you know, and we sort of got on well. I went to his house and his wife and his brothers, and we become friends. And and that was the start of that. In the meantime, we're growing. Our bootleg stuff's getting quite sort of big, and you know, we could have gone inside for it, to be honest with you. You know what I mean? We were real scoundrels. And then what happened is after that is that we decided, why a company approached us through a friend of my friend. My partner at the time was a guy called Toby Russell. His father is Ken Russell, the director. And he said that they wanted to invest into buying and releasing some Hong Kong movies, but they wanted to do them. Sorry. They wanted to do them in original language. Now, prior to this, the whole Kung Fu movies were dubbed and badly dubbed, but he had this vision that they wanted to do them with subtitles. And the reason why this was is because at the time, foreign languages films were doing okay. Art house films were doing okay, HMV and Virgin. And what broke the record was a film called Cyrano de Bergerac with Gerard Depardieu. And so, you know, we felt that even though a lot of people hated reading subtitles, they probably would watch these because there's a lot of fighting. There's no subtitles when they're fighting. And we knew there was a big audience for it because we'd cultivated this underground audience, which me and my partner was the top of the tree. You know, we were the Ronnie and Reggie Clay of the kung fu world. And so we decided that we went along with them, and we said to them, "I think it's a good idea, you know, because they wanted to release them letterbox. Now, letterbox means like widescreen. At that time, TVs were still only 4.3. And so widescreen hadn't really come in. And if it had, it was expensive. So they sent us to Hong Kong. They paid me to go. I've been living to go to Hong Kong. And at the same time, I was quite clever. I read a camcorder. And I said, "Let's film it. And then when we get back, let's make a video magazine." We've got a magazine. You know, we're doing our Eastern Heroes magazine, which is quite low key. I'm going to make a video magazine. And that people, it's like to be in Hong Kong, seeing the stars. And we went over and we managed to talk away and meet a lot of the stars. And I filmed them. We interviewed them. And we got some credibility because we went out there buying films on behalf of this company, which was going to release them on VHS in the original language in a letterbox format and try out something new in the marketplace with some PRing. And so it worked for it worked, you know. People, they were complaining in the beginning because they had these black borders, because if you had a normal TV, you'd see these black borders. You weren't now because we've all got like widescreen TVs. But it worked. And so what's happening is I've done this with Jonathan Ross. My career and my notoriety was building accidentally to the point that I was invited to go to a film festival in Berlin. And this was not long after the Berlin Wall had been knocked down. And we was invited to stay in East Berlin. And we've gone over and the cab drivers don't even know where they're going because the roads kept changing. They've never seen the side of the wall, but we've gone and stayed and we got put up in, what do they call them? In a squat. We got shown to a squat. And my friend, Ted, who I'm doing the book with, has been a friend from the year, he's got long hair. So they said to us when we got there, you have to sleep here. And it was a pallet with a sort of a bit of a manky duvet and two pillars. And he said, that's your room for the night. Sorry, you know what I mean? But we've got to cut the cost. So me and Ken, I said, well, Ken, we've got to have to sleep in that pallet bed together. But I'm so tired, let's just do it. Anyway, in the morning, I remember waking up half asleep. I saw Ken's long brown hair and I thought it was a woman. And it's almost like that scene in Trains, Planes, Automobiles where I sort of put my arm over them and said, morning. I only just realised I'm hugging my mate just because he's got very long silky hair. And I said, oh, sorry, Ken. Oh, God, I said, I must be right mad. And so they took us there. And the most incredible thing happened. We are walking. I've got my suitcase packed with illegal films, kung fu films and stuff. And I'm walking, and magazines, and I'm walking down the road towards the cinema. And about 20 paces before I get there, my suitcase opens up and the content spills onto the floor. And this crowd look around, and one guy shouts out, it is Rick Baker, the Black Marketeer. Let's go. And they all come rushing, like, and they were picking stuff. Well, how much is this? And we sold the entire contents of my suitcase within 10 minutes. And I thought, well, that was good, Ken. So we've got like about £500 here. Mm. And we walked down, and the guy that they were surrounding came up to me and said, who the hell are you? And I said, I'm Rick. We're just here. We're presenting a couple of films here. And I said, who are you? It was on Peter. Little to be known that the guy that I'm talking to was just showcasing his film, was later gone to be the Peter Jackson, who you must have seen, like The Hobbit and King Kong and Lord of the Rings. He's the director.
Yeah.
A Peter Jackson, who's mystified that I'm more famous than him. And we've become sort of good friends until he let me down. So it's, you know, I mean, I'm going on and on and on. I mean, I've cut out so much because it's just too much to tell you. But, you know, at that stage, but the downside to me is that I still had secure, I was still very insecure. And so you could lose yourself in a fantasy world, which I created, which was, you know, not working and just doing what I liked. But it wasn't very secure. And if you met a girl, they liked you in the beginning because you was fun and crazy, but you wasn't, they would just, they'd say to me, you're not good husband material, really. You know, we just, you know, you're just, you know, you're like Peter Pan. You're just too much boyish. And so any serious people wouldn't date me. they wouldn't want to get serious with me anyway. And so I was struggling. Quite a lot with it, because really, to be honest with you, I just wanted to be loved, and I just wanted to settle down, and I wanted to have a child. And that had happened. And again, I jumped. You see, I'd met a girl in the casinos. Very funny story. Very touching story. Really, it was almost Christmas, and we finished at 9 o'clock, and I'd gone to the pub. This is just showing you how life throws so many things at you. You know what I mean? It's like I was living in like a movie. And I walked up and I knew the people upstairs and I knew some of the girls, and I said, soon be Christmas, and they were moaning because some of them had to work Christmas Eve and Boxing Day, but we all had Christmas Day off. And it so happened my days off fell that I had Christmas Day, Boxing Day, and I think New Christmas Eve. And I sat down, and there's a girl opposite me. And I said, oh, wow, I said, you're new. Where have you come from? She goes, oh, I'm Sue. I'm Maddie's sister. I knew Maddie. I said, hi, Sue. And we get talking through the night. And she says to me, where do you live? I said, I have a small place in Pimlico, which I own. And I said, where do you live? Because I'm on my bloody own, aren't I? I said, my family are up the Midlands. I just can't get back home. So it's just me, I'm afraid. And she said, what would you do if you came home on the Christmas Eve and I was in your house? I'd say I'd probably call the police and have you searched, because what are you doing in my house? And she said, no, I said, I'm just saying, I'm on my own. Do you trust me to give me the key? And maybe I'll turn up or maybe I won't. But if I do, I'll be waiting for you when you come in. I said, that's bizarre. I said, why would you do that? You know, she said, I just feel that it's right. I went to her sister. I said, is your sister a nutter? I said, because she spoke to me for 2 hours. And then this 2 hours, she wants me to give her the door key to let herself into my place on the off chance that she might be indoors when I get home. And she said, well, do you want to do it? And I said, of course I do. Of course I do. That's and all that day at work, I was like on edge. But the excitement was so much, I was living it. I was living it because I really liked this girl. And so walking home, I remember walking slowly. Is she going to be there? She's going to be in there, please. You know, and I think the way she delivered it, by the time I'd walked from the tube to there, I was in love with her. And I didn't even know her, but I thought, this woman's so excited. She's so daring. You know, I just don't know how I'm going to handle this when I get to the door. And I've gone to the door because, look, I had two keys. By the way, I gave her a key, but I didn't have a key. I have two keys on this key ring. And I've opened the door, and it's all quiet. I thought, and I've gone to my door, and I've opened the door. It's a studio flat, so there's not many places you can hide. But as I open my door, there's still another door to get into the main room. And I open up there, and she's sitting there in a meditation thing with all tea candles lit. And I said, wow. I said, you're here. She goes, looks like it. And I thought, what? I just sat down by her. And to tell you the truth, we just talked all night. Nothing happened. I was just so happy she was there. We just talked all night. And I think I liked her too much to try anything. I didn't want to make out with some, so I was just very, very nice and kind to her. And she never left. She never left. And then one day, she'd been on some antidepressants and she wanted to come off them. And I went to the doctor with her. And they said that the only way they could do it is if each night I slice a small piece off, bring the dosage down, and that should be the way forward. And I did that for 3 months, caringly. Shortly after that, we went out for dinner. And I think we did one of those special nights. You know, she was happy, she was off, and she says, oh, I've got a feeling again, and this and that. And then about a month later, she said, I don't feel well. And I said, oh, Christ, I'll get a doctor. And so we called a doctor, he came in, and he's examining her, and he's looked at me and says, congratulations. I said, why? What? He said, you're going to be a father. I said, really? And I said, Christ, she's going to be a father. And he said, he went, and I looked at her, and she looked quite strange. And she said, do you mind if I stay at home today? And I said, no, sure, take it easy. I'll go. I come home that night, and she'd gone. And there's a note saying, I'm just not ready for this child. And She lived in Chichester, no, Winchester. And so I've got the phone box and I look at, I've got a parent's number and the dad answered the phone. So Lauren said, it's Rick. He says, yeah. I said, is Sue there? She goes, yeah. I said, look, I've got to see her. He said, well, okay. And he gave me the address. And I went down and I knocked on the door. And he showed me everyone. That's what was there. And she ran up and she hit me so many times in the chest, thumping me. Didn't hurt, luckily. Big guy. Hit me. And I just stood. I said, you had enough? And she said, why? She said, why am I pregnant now? I just don't need this. I said, well, you're Catholic. You're not supposed to, aren't you supposed to rejoice this? And she said, I can't have it, Rick. I just can't have it. I can't have it. And I said, if that's the way you feel, then it's not right for me to put pressure on you. And so she had an abortion and she then come back to the flat and said to me, Rick, I think we need some time apart because I feel that every time we have an argument, you're going to throw it against me. I've just got rid of your child. And I said, you know, I said, no, it's not the situation. I said, we can always try again. And she said, let's have a break. She came for a couple of weeks, and let's have a break, says, because I'm really messed up, because I think I've done something terrible to you, and I think you're really hurting inside. The truth is, I was, but I didn't want her to know that. And so she came, and she said, I'm going to go for a few weeks. So let's have some time apart. And I said, okay. She said, look, ridiculously. She said, I've had Phil still feel like this. Let's have a couple of years apart. And if within the next 2 years, I'll get in touch with you. And let's have a go. And I said, that's ridiculous. Who's going to get in touch after? There's some people to say that. You must have say, you know, if you want to work it out now. But no, please, I think I have to do this. And so we knew my mum was never going to leave that caravan. So she took the caravan's address. And of course, time went by. I never heard from her. But the shocking story is that my mum was a bit of an alcoholic. And what I found out later one night when I came home was that my mum was drunk, and she said to me, and I was married now. I had a wife. And she said to me, by the way, I never told you, I had a letter, didn't I, for you? I said, really? Who's that from? She goes, that's Sue, that one who lost your child to. I said, what, she wrote? She goes, yeah. I said, what did it say? I said, why did you even open it? Because always she said, you know, she thought about it and she wants to get back and she loves you and she wants to get back. And I thought, you're not coming having my son. He's happy now. She said, I burnt it. And this is like many years afterwards. I said, what? I said, she wrote. I said, he didn't get it. I said, no, I burnt it. You know, you're happy now. I said, well, I'd like to have spoke to her. Oh, sorry, I'm going to put my fist in the door. And I never spoke to her for many years after that. I went disappearing. And ended up in a very bad way later, because after that my wife died of cancer. So there's been a lot of tragedy. What I'm trying to say is every door I open seems to be good fortune, but I pay a price with it, usually with either a heartache or a death. And and that's the way it's been to this very day. So, you know, so if I date you, you're going to die. You know, no, I'm not saying it's been the last 10 years is okay, but I'm just saying this is my life is. But the one thing I found gratitude because the one part of the story I would touch upon, and it's probably the worst part of my life, is I become addicted to drugs and I'm not blaming the pain or anything, but I went down some very dark holes for a few years. And I became I didn't know I was an addict to that stage. I was addicted to drugs, and you know, I lost everything. And I think you have to hit rock bottom, and then you can still kick the trapdoor open and go a bit further. but I would I'd become a drug addict.
And how long did that last for?
3 or 4 years. I looked well. People didn't know I was a drug addict. I still looked all right. But I lost everything, you know, because it progressed. Because unfortunately I had the illness, and it was and so I lost a wife, I lost a business, I was homeless, I lived on the streets. And somehow, by finding the meetings, I went to CA, Cocaine Anonymous, and I met some wonderful people. And the nice thing about when you go to those meetings, whether it be for food addiction, gambling, drugs, sex, you're all on the same page. There's a lot of wealthy people there. There was a lot of well-known faces there. But when you're in that room, you're all the same. You're drug addicts that have about lost your way. And I met some really nice people. And the lovely thing about it is, Mimi, is that when you meet people, and the only people who can understand a drug addiction is a drug addict.
Yeah.
It's the truth. You can only understand that yourself. I wasn't a terrible drug addict. I thought I was a nice one, if you say such a thing. But I became addicted to cocaine because I thought it made me feel great, and I could speed around and ended up, you know, injecting it, just searching for that high. You know, I found a woman that was a friend of mine, and I used to sometimes get a someone who'd sit there, and I said, when you walk away the room and you come back in, you look like having a much better time than me. You must be taking different stuff. She goes, no, I'm saying so. I said, it must be. I said, because you look in a lot better place than I am. And then she confessed, she was going to talk because she was injecting the cocaine. And I said, well, Christ, I must try that, as you do. And, of course, you keep looking for that higher level of escapism. But, you know, I found the meetings. I did the work. I spent 3 or 4 years with people who become my very close friends now. And some of them are very rich, but they'd lost it. And we worked together. We helped each other. We call each other every day to see if we're okay. And, you know, the idea is if you have an urge to use, call the person, because it's no good talking to them once you use drugs. No good talking to them because you've gone. You know, if only we could have a cheeky line, and that would be it. Like some people, you know, not us. We're fiends. We have a very addictive nature. So, but that was a great curve for me because I lost everything. I got stripped bare, and then I rebuilt myself through believing in a higher power. And every day writing down gratitude as to how my day was. You know, I woke up, I've got on my limbs, I've got food on the table, I have a roof over my head, I still have some friends. You know, what you have to do in that stage is not look at what other people have got, which is easy to do. You have to look at and be grateful for what you have, because there's a lot of people got a lot less than you. There's a lot of people still out there on the streets, selling their bodies, stealing, living in terrible conditions. I escaped it. And through working with other people, that led me to going into prisons. That led me to going into doing chairs. And you do those things because it helps you. You know, they thank you for helping them, but really you're keeping yourself in a safe place because you look at people. You know, the only time that I ever laughed in a meeting was I went to an overeaters because I started to overeat. And my friend owns a scrapyard, and he'd helped me out when I lost everything. He gave him some work because we met in the meetings, and he was so successful. And I quite liked him going out to dinner in his Bentley. So I felt like for a moment I had my life back, even though it was just fake. Just to be sitting in the Bentley, I thought, I've got my life back. Thank God for Matthew. And we'd become really close friends. And he said, we're eating rubbish. We should go to the overeaters meeting. And I walked in there and everybody was so thin. And I laughed. I said, where's the people with overweight? I said, we're the two biggest guys in here. And they sat down and introduced them, and their method of helping you is 301. Three meals, no desserts once a day. You just eat breakfast, nothing in between, nothing like that. And they had to share. And the only time I've ever laughed, which was terrible, if there's any light humor to these stories, was there's a very pretty girl with her boyfriend who was a footballer or an apprentice. You know, he was one of the famous ones. And they were telling the stories, and this girl said how she worked in a high-end job, and at nighttime she'd sit in front of the fridge, eat food like an animal, and then make herself sick. And you know, but they were all, but so it wasn't so much they were just greedy people, they had real eating disorder issues. But the girl that looked nice said that she'd suffered with bulimia, etc., and that she loved food and that she loved sweet things. And then she said, but I've managed to just get a job and I'm working nights in a cake factory. And I just burst out laughing. I thought, what? That's like saying I've given a drug, but in the evening I'm bagging up cocaine for a dealer. You know, and they looked at me and I just thought, why would you do that to yourself? But I went through, I met a lot of good people, I helped a lot of people, I spent time helping people. And I think that rebuilt my character back up by before I think I was it made me a better person. Believe it or not, all the things I've been through led up to me becoming a much nicer, better person. And I managed to get my job, my company, well, sort of back. You know, I managed to sort of get back into what I mean. I'm so lucky that you blew away a fortune, ended up on the streets, come back and start again. And it's a much tougher job as you're getting older because you don't have so much time left. You know what I mean? You can't, you know, try to, well, I'll just do a new career. You know, you're thinking this is the sort of time I should be retiring and yet I'm starting all over again in the last few years. So it's much harder. It's only because I had a good name amongst the people out there that didn't know my other side of the life that it went in. But I always still live my life today by the gratitude, and I always try to be as kind as I can and not judgmental to people. And I like to go to bed at night and think, did I have a good day today? Could I have done anything better? Most days you think you can, but you know, as long as you didn't do things where you go to bed and you've said something or you've done something you wish you hadn't done, then that troubles me. So the thing I learned the most is don't say anything too rash, because once it's out there, you can't take it back. So always think what you're going to say to somebody before you blurt it out, and be kind. And today, like you said, I've got my magazine back. I'm trundling along. There's a few good things on the horizon, maybe making a movie. I've got a documentary. And the most thing is I'm trying to finish this book. So to get it all back, but you know, the terrible thing is without putting all these things in my place, it would take no effort to break them all. You know, you never become cured of this disease. It's always there. You know, if you're allergic to something, that's it. You know, if you have certain things in life, you know, that's it. I guess the only thing that slows me down right now is just age, really. And that doesn't really stop me too much. And, you know, I'm still very young. I'm still, you know, quite active. So I won't sound like I'm an old person. I don't really look like an old person. So I'm quite okay with it. But deep down, I always talk to like a higher power, whatever that is. It doesn't necessarily mean religious, but I do believe in destiny. I do believe in serendipity. And I do believe that things are sent into my life for a good reason, whether they be small or sometimes big. And I try to make sure people that I meet that I have the same impact on their life. You know, that I'm good to them. And so they, you know, however, in such a small way. And I think it's that karma that keeps me stable. I'll let you talk.
And here you are. And here you are. And here you are living this life, Ricky, that is absolutely extraordinary, listening to this life story and everything that you've been through. And there is a thread, I think, through everyone's life, and that being of wanting to find love.
You know something? Why do people search for love? Because it can be such a painful thing. I've often mused about that, that people look for love and look for this, and yet it's like a drug. You know, in the beginning, it seems great, but, you know, it can hurt you as well. You know, I mean, there's a very flip side to love that can hurt you. And although we all crave it, you know, at what cost, at what pain are you going to pay for love? I mean, that's my feeling, is that love is fantastic. It's nothing better than being in love. Nothing better than being totally happy and adoring the person you're with, and you know, you couldn't be with you. You don't feel whole without them. That's very rare. My brother and my sister found the same partners for like 50 years. My brother's in his 70s. My sister's in late 60s. You know, they're older than me, but they've done something, and yet I've failed. And I sometimes think I've done everything, but I've failed to really make that childhood sweetheart. I did have children. And I've married my first wife. We're still good friends. And my second wife died of cancer. But then again, I hurt a lot of people on the web. You know, a lot of people who did like me, I hurt them. So maybe this is punishment for me, you know, for breaking a few hearts. I don't know. Maybe.
But it's never too late, Ricky.
I think so. I think it is.
No. It isn't. It isn't.
I think you can love your job. You can love an animal. There's two. Let me explain this to you. There's two sorts of loves. There's I love that person. Love him. But the highest form of love is when you say I'm in love with that person. And I know a lot of people who say that. They might say I love him. I love them. But are they in love? We see it in the movies. And we see these rom-coms and these happily ever afters. But I wonder how many people I know, even my friends who've got good relationships, have I looked at me and I said, you love your wife? Yes. But are you in love? I think there's a big difference between love, because being in love is where you're totally, you know, you take a bullet for them. I guess you might do that if you want to. But I think there's a big difference. And I think so finding love in today's world, with computers, with all these different things, and the internet, which is a killer, where people can, you know, use it for dating apps. I've never used a dating app for anything in my life. I would never do it. I'm too old for that sort of thing. But I see people going on there. How can you meet the person of your dreams on a dating app? It's the same chance to meet him in an aisle. You know, but people seem so desperate, some people, and not being funny, a lot of ladies that I met seem desperate to want to have the man, the thing, but that's not enough, because if you don't love that person properly, you haven't got the strength to build it. You'll crack at the first problem, you know. So it's okay being on holiday, you can have a nice time, you can have this honeymoon period with somebody, you know. I could give somebody the best 2 weeks of their life probably. But it's not real, you know what I mean? I want to see what they're like if we're living in a tent, or if we're, you know, we come in the house. I think love is tested in extreme circumstances, not if everything around you is lovely. That's my feeling anyway.
I mean, love, it's such a huge subject, and it's something that propels us as mankind. I think all of creation, in fact, not just mankind, even if you look at animals and birds and whatever it is out there, everything has this yearning for love. If you are kind to an animal, to a bird, it feels it, let alone to a human being. But I think true love, indeed, is something that is difficult to find. But I always believe also in the fact that if you look, it's one of the most elusive things out there. it actually is the other way around. I'm a firm believer in this, is that we are fundamentally, all of us, love. And there is an essence within all of us that joins all of us. And sometimes the people that you fall in love with are the people that you would never think that you would fall in love with and can have a future with somebody. But unless we have that serenity of, I suppose, the belief in ourselves that we are actually loving beings, and we are comfortable in that, that we totally accept ourselves for who we are and love ourselves. And I don't mean that in an arrogant way. Actually be grateful, as you say, for who we are. I don't think we're able then to extend that beyond ourselves.
But if do you not find that sometimes that we can find love, but it has to be reciprocated, doesn't it? It's finding someone you could love is probably in your head, in my head, we've seen people, we think I could love them, but it has to be reciprocated. And that's not always the case, is it?
No, but then that is then, as you say, you know, destiny, then it's not meant to be. I have moments in my life, and I'm always saying this with a particular friend of mine. I have moments when you're going along the M1 and you just think to yourself, oh, I love everybody on the motorway. It's one of those beautiful feelings. And that's because that is how I am feeling in that moment. And I love everybody. And then there are days, Ricky, when I don't want to be friendly with anybody. And I just think, no, I just can't be doing with that. So fundamentally, it comes from us. It comes from within. And I am the type of person who has made my life be love. I have tried, people say, no, you know, you live your life in this ideal world, but I like it. And
well, that's fine, isn't it?
You know, absolutely.
And everybody's version of ideal can be different, but
of course,
I tend to think as we get older, maybe we can be more considerate about love. It's not like when you're a young person and you know you're out there, you know, living your life, you know, meeting various people. But still, often than not, in life, the person you might meet, I've known people that wanted to love me and I liked them, but I wouldn't waste their life by just pretending. And I could have had a comfortable life if I'd have been that sort of way, but I tend to feel that you feel envious that, look, God, they love me, and yet, you know, I'm not giving it back. And I think that's quite cruel, you know, if you can't,
you don't have to give it back, because really? Well, if you don't feel it, you don't feel it. But there are these extraordinary moments where you do feel it. And I think mostly people are afraid. And that is what stops a lot of people from entering into relationships, I think, that could be magical because of the fear. Well, love, as you said earlier, love hurts. No, love doesn't hurt. It's people. And love is a completely different substance, which is a whole nother podcast episode.
Yes, but I do, like I said, I think it's, I you know, I do love romantic and I do like the films when it all works out. But I'm just saying that I think depending on how life's treated you, you know, if you've been lucky in life with relationships where there has been a lot of love, you perceive it differently. I think it depends on how life has been to you. And like you said, even if you both love each other, life can be cruel and take one person away. And that's the worst kind, because at least before you can analyze it and think, well, I did that, or they did that, or they cheated on me. When somebody's taken away from you and it's just because of death and nothing you either did, that's quite hard to swallow.
That is another type of sorrow and sadness. But nevertheless, it is better. You said this to me a while back. What was that saying that you said? It is better to have loved and lost than never to have loved.
No, I agree with you, because I think it's a very shallow life if you haven't loved. And, you know, and like you said, I think love is on many different levels. But because of the truth is, because of what I've gone through and because of today, you know, I live a different life. You know, I'm probably more accepting, and I'm not probably so suspicious of it, because there's no guarantee, is there, with anything. You've got to go into something and at least give it a go, you know, rather than just keep telling yourself it's not going to work, because you don't know. But I think even love sometimes is not enough. It takes two people to really work at the relationship, doesn't it? And love alone just, I don't think, can survive a relationship. I think it has to, I think there has to be a certain amount of work and understanding. And you sometimes can, and like you said, you know, I think the most scary thing is this instant love, because there's no build up to it. You're there and your heart's taken over your head, and you're scared, because your mind's trying to say to you, no, take it easy. But then when you have that sort of like heart pounding feeling, that's worrying.
No, it is not worrying. I don't want people out there now to be afraid of falling in love.
No, I'm not saying encourage it, Ricky. I think we're telling our own story here. And I've seen my brother and my sister, and I know people, my wife's mother and father, I know a lot of people that have been very, that are very happy and still in love today. It just seems to have eluded me.
But look, you have to have hope, because you never know what is around the corner or who is around the corner.
No, you don't. You don't. And I'm not saying, you know, that that's a thing. But it's what I like is, you know, somebody told me once, and let me explain this to you. I live quite a positive life, and I try to always think positive. And they drew this circle, and inside was other circles. They got to like a bullseye, and then they drew it in petitions. So you had like 6-7 petitions. And on the first one, and they around them, they wrote things. And the first one, they said, work. Where would you rate your work happiness? And it goes from 1 to 10, so you might go, 8 for me. Okay. Family, where do they come at? Dependents, let's say 5. Food, money. You'd go around this chart and you'd fill it in. And when you looked at it, when it was filled in, it had like sort of like a checkerboard, some were high, some were low, and this. And he said to me, you know what? When all those circle, when you fill it in and it's a perfect shaded circle inside, that everything is a 5 or a 6 or a 4, whatever it might be. When you're living your life where everything is at the same number, then you've got what you have, you know, you're content. But for most people, if they did it, you know, if they were truthful, you know, when they went around it, they could be all over the place, like a graft. But he said the way to aim to is to make sure they're all either 10 or 9 or 8, so that you're in a perfect harmony, and that everything has the same level of enjoyment to you. What do you think about that?
I think theories are fine, but once love touches your life, everything goes out of the window, all reasoning goes out of the window, and life becomes magical. And that, Ricky, is the feeling that we should never say no to.
No, I tend to agree. But I think as you get older, it's about, I think if you can feel content and secure, I think there are two major elements in your life that, you know, because you don't do crazy things. If you're happy, nobody wants to destroy happiness. So if you're happy, happy with your surroundings, happy with the people, happy with the person you're with, you're not going to damage that. I think people only damage things or go in the wrong direction when things aren't tickety-boo. And I think if you're I think if you're in life, if you feel content and you're happy, it will save you, and you'll probably try your best to maintain that. Whereas if things aren't so good, you'll make the wrong decisions.
Sometimes yes, and sometimes no, because sometimes being human is a tricky little thing. And sometimes when we find happiness, we don't recognize that happiness, or we don't recognize that person. And there are many factors. I don't think it's simply that clear cut. Sometimes you do have that person and it's good for you, but for whatever you've been through, as you said earlier, through your life and however you've grown up and the experiences that have shaped you through life, until we have resolved something within us, I don't think even if we had an ideal situation, we could actually accept it. So there are many factors there, but everything beautiful grows with love. And I have so many guests on here who say the same thing. You know, love is, what is your message? And nearly everybody is saying to me, love is the answer.
Well, that's what Brian Ferry said. But I guess everybody's got their own story, and it depends, you know. And so, you know, they all have. I think it must be wonderful. There's so many people that do find, you know, a lot of people where I came from, they marry within their vision. Now, if you don't know what I mean by that, they marry within their vision. That means the people they see at work or the people they meet in the pub. And so it's a very small circle of people. You know, there is somebody for everybody out there, but they may not be living in your town or hanging in your pub or working in your office or factory.
Most so definitely.
People always seem to settle. Now, today with the internet and Zooming and this, you know, you can meet people from far, and I've traveled around the world. And a lot of my friends, you know, seem to, although, you know, they seem to, back there, they seem to have got through life. But I always thought to myself that your partner, your soulmate, is not, unless you're very lucky, it's probably not living next door to you. They probably in another country. They could be in Egypt. They could be in India. They could be in America. And sometimes you think to yourself, how will I ever locate this person? Because it's such a big world. How do you find? Because there is somebody out there that will make you totally happy, and you'll make them totally happy. But finding them could take a lifetime, because, like you said, due to work and due to commitments and due to where we're geographically located, we are very much stuck with having to sort of search out our partners in a very small group, rather than, you know, getting the chance to see people around the world. You know, and I guess there's many people out there that would fit us. You know, there's not just one person. I guess there is quite a few people in certain parts of the world that we met them, we could have a happy life with. But I think a lot of people settle for just what's in their vision. And that's why probably some of the relationships don't work. They all seem good in the beginning, but I don't know if you agree with me, you know, it's unlikely that your soulmate is living in the same town as you, unless you're extremely lucky.
Yeah, quite possibly. But then again, there is destiny. And I think if you are meant to be with somebody, it doesn't matter what country, what continent they're on, it will align. There will be an alignment that will happen just at the right time for you to meet that person.
I agree with you, because that's how it seems to have been for me. I've never sort of been introduced by somebody, you know, gone for a blind date, or, you know, been hooked up. You know, it's always, people I've met have always been by chance, you know, as bumping into each other, as, you know, meeting. Not because somebody said, oh, you know, my friend there. And I think that's a bit more, you know, that's a little bit more realistic, because you've not been forced together. Whereas in some cases, you know what I mean, you are. They say that more affairs happen at work, because you end up spending more time with your co-worker than you do your wife. So a lot of people, like say, this is why so many people have affairs, I think, because they're not happy at home. They don't really want to leave. They might be secure. They might think they're a good husband, but they're not fulfilling them. And I think that's why a lot of people have affairs, not because they're cheats, but there's something lacking in their life. And you need to be able to get that from the person you're with.
And it's a throwaway society. People don't work through their relationships now as they did, say, 100 years ago or even 50 years ago. If you don't like someone after 5 months or 5 days, people are moving on. They have no patience.
It is a very much quicker moving world out there now. I think the internet has done it. You know, there's a real, you know, I used to love receiving letters when I was younger from girlfriends. When I was in New Zealand, I had a girlfriend back in England, and we wrote on it. So I loved getting her letters. It was interested in read, or a cassette with a music tape on it. And I think it's so instant now. And like you say, you can go on to a dating app and swipe left, swipe right. I have no interest in it. I like to meet people properly. I wouldn't just go on these tickety boo things. I do know a few people who've done it, and it's been disastrous. So, you know, you need to, but we are in a society today where it's so easy to be distracted, to go out and hook up with somebody via an app. I don't think marriage is going to be as stable as it was in the next generation.
Yeah, it's it's an interesting subject, and you'll have to come back again, Ricky, and we can talk about it more. But really, thank you so much for sharing your incredible story tonight. And wow.
Let me just end by saying that, you know, just because maybe I sound a bit there, you know, I do truly believe in love. And I do believe that, you know, that I do believe in destiny. And I do think that if your mind's reaching out, it can attract a lot of things. It has done for me. And, you know, I think it's, you know, like they say, if you get up in the morning and do the same thing every day, day in, day out, you're only going to get the same results. I think people have to expand a bit and realize that, you know, that the only way life's going to change them is if they slightly change something in their own life. Yeah. That's the way to do it, rather than just repeating, which a lot of people do. People love routine, but it may not be giving the full satisfaction that you want. And so doing shows like this, talking with you, and what I do, you know, you're coming across a lot of people. It does bring into a lot of contact, a lot of interesting people. And so your life is different. It's not the same. And I guess that's the same for you too.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Ricky, where can people get hold of you and look at your work and all
the things? They can find me in Isle 4 of Waitrose.
Oh, yes, Isle 4.
by the freezers. I mean, look, if you're interested in Hong Kong cinema, then, you know, I'm your dream guy. A lot of my name, the company's Eastern Eras, and you can type into Amazon. You know, I have, like, 40 or 50 books up there, photographing on the subject. And, you know, I have a website, easternheroes.com. But realistically, it's if you're into Hong Kong cinema, you know, if you're into Jackie Chan, Bruce Lee, then you've just found the go-to guy in the world. If you're not, then it's like somebody trying to, you know, have a website that I have no interest in. But I mean, you know, sometimes there are people that enjoy it, and there's a new generation of people. But, you know, all I'll say is if you can do something you love in life, even if the money's not great, it's priceless. It's priceless. And you get to meet lots of people like you.
Yeah, and people like you.
I'm not the same, but you're nice.
Oh, well, thank you, Ricky. And please do come back again. It will be a pleasure to talk to you. And maybe we can embrace that subject of love
I'm an expert.
It's a very interesting one. So, but I wish you all the very best. And I wish you a wonderful rest of the evening.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. And take care.
Good night.
Good night. Ricky Baker. Fascinating story. Thank you so much for joining me today. And I wish you fantastically beautiful moments. Until next time, look after yourselves and lots of love.
Thank you for listening to Secrets for an Inspirational Life, brought to you by your host, Mimi Novick. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast and see you in the next episode. For more information about Mimi Novick and her books, music, and inspirational work, take a look at her website, www.miminovick.co.uk.